I think some of Trevor's kind of more gloomier tones segue us nicely into our first panel on distress. I think to start off, I think it's clear that there's not enormous widespread distress just yet, but we're seeing it creeping through in areas of secondary retail, perhaps parts of the London residential market. And knowing where distress might come from is crucial for those already invested in those markets and for those thinking of sinking large amounts of capital into where there might be holes emerging. However, from distress inevitably becomes opportunity. And we have some of the industry's most notorious experts at finding those opportunities and turning them around to ask where they see distress emerging and how they might look to react. If I could just ask our wonderful panel to come up to the stage. Superb. Well, guys, if I could just ask you to kick off and introduce yourselves and tell the audience a little bit more about yourselves, starting with Roger.
Hi, I'm Roger Orff. I work with Apollo Global Management. I've been in Europe for the last 30 years. I came over with Goldman Sachs and been a real estate investor over that period of time with Goldman and now with Apollo.
Cameron. Good morning. My name's Cameron Spry. I am responsible for the investments we make at Tristan Capital Partners. We're a mid-size opportunity fund, real estate private equity business. And prior to that, I was working at Fortress, where Cyril currently occupies the joy of that.
So, good morning. I'm Arif Laham. I run Orion Capital Management's investment team. We're basically a pan-European business, like Cameron's, investing in real estate across Europe and the UK. We've been around since 1999, and before that, I was at LaSalle Partners in the early 90s.
I'm Andy Pyle. I lead KPMG's UK real estate business. I work on helping investors buy commercial real estate in large lot sizes, so big portfolios like Logical, for instance. In the downturn, I spent 6 months in Dubai on the workout of Dubai World and all of its real estate businesses. So that was pretty interesting times as well.
And last but not least.
Cyril Corbage. I run Fortress's real estate business in Europe. We tend to focus generally a bit like other colleagues here on Western Europe. We have business outside of the US and in Japan as well. But my predominant focus is Western Europe.
I want to start and kick off just by asking the open question, which is there any one particular area or sector, geography, where you think there's a real chance of there being exposure to distress or change in the next 6, 12, 18 months? And Roger, as your nearest, you can kick us off.
So we're talking about Europe or about...
Yeah, I think we'll keep it confined to Europe, if that's right.
Okay. Well, I think if you're talking about NPLs, there's probably a lot more NPLs on the continent today. There was just a big trade that everyone on the panel and probably everyone in the audience is aware of that occurred in Spain that went with one of our competitors through a bank merger. I think there'll be other bank mergers in Spain. I think the consequence of that will be there'll be NPL sales coming out of those transactions as they remove bad assets from their balance sheets. And there also may be some deals in Italy, albeit that's a opaque market and one that's quite difficult to get the requisite transparency to make investments. So those would be the two areas of focus and the areas of focus for what we're doing today.
And obviously you guys were... So the said transaction was the Popular transaction that came out of Santander that ended up with Blackstone, unfortunately, and Apollo may or may not have been in the running. You're obviously interested in that Spanish market, and why are you seeing? Why are you kind of as involved in Spain as you are?
Well, we've been involved there for years. We own a bank there. We own a big service. We're in partnership with Banco Santander, servicing their assets. They've got 25 billion of NPLs and of REO, real estate owned. So the breadth and depth of what we do there is large. We bought a lot of NPLs from Spanish banks, and we like the market. We like the market because after Ireland, arguably, it's done the best job of cleaning up the banking system and improving the labor laws. So there's been growth there that's drastically ahead of other continental European countries. The risks that we see in the market on a macro basis are, I think it's kind of got two legs. One is hospitality, and the other is real estate. And, you know, I think Spain probably needs to diversify outside of those two areas if it's going to continue to have growth. But we think it's quite an interesting market.
Cameron, how about you? Where are you crystal ball gazing? Any areas of particular concern or opportunity?
Yeah, I think we're perhaps more of a fundamental real estate investor than Apollo, and we're certainly not as involved in the NPL space. So we look at the stress in a slightly different way, in the sense that we're focused on occupational distress and then investment distress and where there are opportunities to invest into it. And I think, a bit like Roger, I think Southern Europe, including Italy, is interesting, largely because the banks haven't, but are in the process of going through their restructuring in terms of transferring NPLs out into the market. You know, I think that process has certainly ended, or predominantly ended in the UK and probably Ireland. For us, though, we then look at where, from a real estate perspective, we can invest into a market that is recovering, and I think Spain is a very good example of that. You know, you're starting to see real recovery in the real estate sector and rents even in the larger cities. Italy, we've been quite active. Every Italian deal we've been involved with has been unbelievably painful. For every one Italian deal we've closed, we've been involved in about 1,000. So it is an appalling use of our time, and constantly makes me question whether I know what I'm doing.
That's the question I was going to naturally ask, and I know Arif has been kind of done several deals in Italy as well. Can you justify the kind of time reward, and how do you kind of actually get things done? Is it showing enough potential in returns? First to Cameron and then to Arif.
to be determined. I think the deal we've just closed is pretty interesting. So I'm reasonably confident. I think it's just difficult. I think culturally, the way it works, the system doesn't encourage creditors to. It doesn't encourage transaction flow, and I think that's the difference with Ireland and then Spain in terms of some of the changes they made to the system. I'm hopeful. I think there's a lot of recapitalization that has to happen in the country, and so at some point they'll have to change the way it works.
Arif, do you agree? Would that be one of the areas that you picked out?
I agree a lot with what Cameron said, but we actually like Italy, and we have performed, and we have been there since 2000, where we have an office. So sure, culturally it's different. We like the fact that it's opaque. We like the fact that you don't read about the deal that you're doing in the State Gazette before it happens. But we like the fact that it's more complicated, and that helps us get more value. I like Italy because I think it's the one where still banks have to shed a lot of assets. And a lot of the assets that they have to shed requires work and capital expenditures, which plays to our strength in terms of repositioning assets. So certainly we'd say Italy is one of our top spots at the moment. Yes, it's sure it's difficult to do deals, but at least you feel you're buying fundamental value. We're not great momentum investors at Orion in terms of saying if the market is moving and let's buy and rents are going to rise by X and so on. And we tend to see a lot of that happening now in a lot of the European cities, whether it's Paris or Madrid or in Germany, where people are taking leasing risks and not really factoring in the risk rate return appropriate for that risk.
All the ones you've sold out of, basically.
Yeah, it's easy to sell today as everybody's looking for yield. It's more complicated to invest. But going back to distress, I think post the financial crisis, a lot of the banks inherited a lot of the assets, and they're shedding them slowly, whether it be in Germany or Italy or Spain or even in France. And those are the ones that we're hunting down. And luckily, there's still a few around. In Ireland less, obviously, and the UK less. Spain, to a large extent, also, because most of the assets now that are in the hands of the banks are land, and land is quite difficult to shift. But, you know, the open-ended funds until recently have been shedding assets in Germany. That's been a great look into. And so I'd say Germany and Italy have been more our cup of tea lately than Spain and France.
Andy, how about you looking in the crystal ball? And any areas where you think you will predict that there might show the odd sign of distress?
I think as you know, our first speaker said, we're actually in quite a benign economic environment. It feels like the market is bumbling along. We have odd pockets of bad or not great news, and then the next week there's a prime asset that's sold for the highest amount per square foot or the lowest cap rate that we've actually seen. So it feels as though that there's plenty of capital that's out there. I don't think that there's quite the anywhere near the level that we had pre-crisis of over-leveraged assets sitting there to be worked out. And I think that's evident by, you know, a number of my fellow panelists having to actually work probably a lot harder to go and source interesting transactions that are off market and where there's value to be had than there were. So I feel as though there sort of needs to be some kind of change or external shock that will then have an impact and create some distress. So I suppose as an example, broadly BHS going bust was weathered from a retail perspective and the centres have been relet. But if you had a series of retailers all go down because of the increasing cost pressures that they're going to be under, then there's bound to be some retail parks or shopping centres in particular that will become distressed, and that will then provide buying opportunities for people. There'll be other examples as well.
Cyril, you've been relatively active on the retail side as well. You've found some opportunities within retail in the UK.
Well, retail is a sector which is fundamentally shifting. It's probably not as acute as a problem that exists in the US, just because the amount of square footage per capita in Europe is, I think, 1 to 5 versus the US on average. In Southern Europe, it's 1 to 8. So the fundamental shift of retail is probably occurring the same way as it is, but in a less acute way. I think there's also a big difference in the UK is that internet penetration is a lot higher as a percentage of retail sales than it is, interestingly, even in the US. Having said all of that, there's a fundamental shift. There's a lot of soul searching around secondary and tertiary shopping centres in the UK, and I can't see anybody wanting to catch a falling knife in that respect. Yes, there are fundamentally interesting retail investments to be made in the UK and in Europe in retail and elsewhere, but trying to find the bottom on a tertiary shopping centre in the UK right now is probably not where we're going to be. Having said that, there's an interesting article in the FT, to come back to Italy, there's an interesting headline in the FT this morning which announced a significant reduction of NPLs in the Italian banks, primarily driven by the growth in capital values. But by the time you get to the second or the third line of the article, they're actually still confirming that it's the single largest NPL market in Europe. So you get the headlines and then you dig deeper. Italy's still a very interesting and delightfully opaque market.
That's the problem with journalists. Talking of the UK retail market, we just so happen to have two relatively major owners of UK retail on the panel in Cameron and Arif. So I'd be interested.
It's interesting because we own probably in the portfolio is probably 4 or 5 UK shopping centres.
that I would put into the bucket of secondary, well, there's the market would define secondary. And what's quite interesting is, you know, there's clearly, the UK retail market right now is trying to deal with the cyclical problem of cost pressures that I think Andy, you know, mentioned in terms of retail margins associated with, principally some of the changes in labour laws in terms of the apprentice levy, and also the currency and how that's pushed up costs. And then it's got structural issues that I think Cyril mentioned in terms of the internet. If you look at, most of the centres we own are what we would sort of describe as needs-based, convenience-type centres. And if you talk to the tenants, they are principally worried about the cyclical problems in the market. The internet penetration and the internet effect, I think, to most of them now, feels principally a historic problem. And, you know, the shopping centres, the rents might have halved over time, so it hasn't been friendly to UK retail real estate. But I think most of the retailers would look at the cyclical pressures as being the predominant problem they face. I think when we look across the portfolio, where the defining feature in terms of the shopping centre performance is ultimately about whether it dominates its catchment. If you have a strong catchment, even if it's a relatively small catchment, if you have a strong catchment, the retailers are doing reasonably well. And occupationally, forget the investment market and catching a falling knife, but the occupational market is pretty good. Where you don't dominate your catchment, it is a bloodbath. I think ultimately the investment market will wake up to that. Whether there's a distressed investment market that comes off the back of it is ultimately going to be whether people need to sell or not. You know, we refinanced some of the centres last year with our bank. You know, we're generating a double-digit cash-on-cash return, out of owning it. So it's difficult for us to accept the price when we, are making a strong income return. And Arif, do you want to?
We see the same occupational demand. And as long as you have centres that have tenants and are paying the rent and you have footfall, then it works. Where it's happened is that Cameron talked about the demand, and I agree with it. What's interesting is the capital markets and this wave that started in the US of saying disruptive technology is going to hurt the way we shop and therefore the retail centers, and it is to a large extent, but that has now spread like a fire, and where institutions are saying we don't want to touch that class of asset because we don't know what's going to happen to it. You see that in the US in a terrible way, and you're starting to see that in the UK, where British institutions are sort of really out of the market. I mean, interestingly, they're buying very small shopping centres that, 10, 20 million, and they're paying very expensively for it, sort of as a premium to get liquidity so that if they have a run on their fund again, they can sort of sell them. But, anything 50 million plus is sort of become very illiquid, and you see that reflection in the public markets with the discount to NAV that a lot of the real estate companies are showing. And the question mark and valuation is going to be really, what are they worth? What's a retail park really worth if it's not primary or secondary? And so as the valuations start to run down, and the capital markets are not buying those assets, these become assets that are very interesting for people like Orion, because we know the asset type very well, we can manage it, we know the retailers, we can add value, and if somebody has to sell, it becomes an interesting play, because fundamentally we believe, like Cameron said, if you dominate your catchment area and you can lease it and you can have a healthy spread between where interest rates are and what the yield that you buy it at, we'll hold it all day long. So
I would add to that. I think this dominate your catchment area is just a different way of looking at it, because typically people have said, look, primary is great, secondary is bad, and that's very clearly not correct. I think that the situation that we're in means that you need to have a much more sophisticated way of looking at individual assets. Similarly, post the Brexit referendum, everyone says city offices must be bad because jobs will leave as a result of Brexit. And that analysis is just grossly simplistic because we've just seen two prime, new developed city office buildings trade at a very, very high price. Why? Because they're brand spanking new, they're great buildings, and they've got, what, 13 to 15 years of absolutely rock-solid income that is not going to be impacted by a few tens of thousands of jobs moving out. There are other city offices that are sitting there either today on 20 to 30% vacancy or with upcoming lease events and are in areas where the tenant base is going to have more of an impact from jobs shifting off. And those are going to be some really interesting situations over the next few years, so that you're going to get this complete bifurcation. And it actually comes down to the skills of, you know, the people here and out in the market to pick the right assets and situations to go into based on looking at the fundamentals, rather than just a blanket generalisation that asset class X is good and asset class Y is bad.
There must surely be some sort of end game, though, or somebody being left holding the baby in retail or otherwise. And do you see a situation where not private equity firms are perhaps not under distress but are coming into the category towards forced buyers from an IRR perspective, and that we might see a trend of private equity buying from private equity? Roger.
Well, many of the funds, by their constitutions, everyone knows has a finite life, unlike British Land or Land Securities or whatever. So all of us are faced with an end date. And, of course, you can always defer the end date often by a year or two by going back to your investors, or you can do this as a GP and say, we're going to wait for another year. It's not the right time to sell. So definitely, we experience funds where we're trying to clean things up at the end, and often you leave some assets behind, somewhat because you may hope that the values are going to go up, or somewhat that you may know that the values are going to go up. But I can think of a couple of funds, I think, that have been taken over by other funds because, you could be crass and say they've done a bad job, or you could say they didn't plan or whatever. Sometimes this happens. I think that the crisis separated to an extent some of the men from the boys, and in some instances there was takeover of funds. But today, do I see that out there as a trend? No. I mean, not at present. And I just don't think that the funds that were represented on this panel would ever be in a crisis because they will plan for dispositions. So I don't see that as a great area for us to be buying assets. However,
and we only ask the best private equity firms to come on our panels, of course. Yeah, exactly. It's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I mean, there's some on the continent and some in Italy that we have bought from where I think the finite life, there really is a finite life. And in those instances, you often go, and it's very complicated to buy from a bank-sponsored fund in Italy, but we've done some of that to our advantage because they really do have to sell.
I think the finite life nature of the closed-end fund industry is going to create some selling of assets if the current situation continues for 2, 3, 4 years. Or what I would say almost on the flip side is there's a lot of funds out there that I think hold assets that maybe, where this bit off a spread issue and maybe in terms of the shopping centre exists, which have been extremely profitable funds where GPs may just take the decision that actually they're willing to live with a bad price on one asset if the remaining funds. So I actually think your question is a good one in terms of is the nature of the closed-end fund structure going to eventually force people to sell? I don't think it's going to force anyone to sell because I think it's ultimately a negotiation with your LPs, but what I do think is some people are going to sell out of these assets anyway at prices they may not like because the rest of the fund has performed very well. And, you know, that's particularly, I think, the case with funds raised, you know, 2011, 2012, 2013, because in many cases, you know, a lot of the other deals have performed extremely strongly.
I mean, I would add to that is that retail as a asset class requires capex, and some of the people that have inherited those assets may not have calculated on having to spend the capex, so they may hold on to them, but eventually things deteriorate if you don't spend the money on it, and at some point they sort of kind of forced to sell to somebody who will spend the capex because they know if they keep holding it, it will just get worse. So I think that's the differential in this kind of type of asset. It's quite capital intensive, whether it's TIs to bring retailers in or to expand or to move things around. And some of these funds that have inherited these from NPL situations may not have calculated that much capex to spend. So they'll hold it, they'll drain it, the value comes down. At some point, they trade it. Somebody puts the capex and takes it up again.
Obviously, the last time we saw real widespread distress, it was a banking phenomenon, as Andy has touched on, and you know, leverage is nowhere near the levels that it was back then. But are we seeing any signs of any banks becoming? We can prod and poke them on this later because we've got a panel of a lot of them later. But talking from the buyer's perspective, are you seeing any sort of jittery nature from the banks themselves, Cyril?
Well, being jittery actually requires a lot of discipline, which most continental European banks have failed to demonstrate on a regular basis. So no would be my intuition. The only discipline we've seen has been really from the Anglo-Saxon banks, and I mean Ireland and the UK. And yeah, that's led to the results we've seen, where you've effectively drained most of the financial institutions of a large, most, not all, most of the financial institutions of a large part of their, you know, problem balance sheets. That's not the case in Europe. It's never been the case in Europe. In the early late 90s, there were issues in the UK, issues on the continent, and the European banks postponed the problem, and then the problem came back, and they're postponing the problem again. So jitters, no. I think there's a lack of self-awareness, which allows for lack of jitters.
Probably,
to a great degree.
Yeah. Probably not. Anybody would disagree? Maybe anybody would say banks are a happy hunting ground for buying.
No, but sorry, I'm not suggesting they're not a happy hunting ground. We spend, in some jurisdictions, we spend quite a bit of time with varying degrees of success actually doing that. But jitters, I don't think there's anything untowards today which is different to 2 years ago, which suggests that any current affairs, macro or otherwise, is going to mean an increase of that supply.
Right.
What, you know, is there a continued supply from some of the institutions? Yes. Spain still has a big pool. Italy still has a big pool, and others are busy creating it.
I think. I think, you know, what's been interesting in this cycle, you know, from my perspective, is the banks, I think, have been relatively, you know, relatively well behaved, if that's the right way of saying it, in terms of their leverage, in terms of the way that they provide leverage. I think. You know, where you've had higher leverage loans, generally those loans have been split or, you know, bifurcated and sold off to more, you know, mezzanine or high yield investors. The alternative lenders have come in and also provided higher leverage, but again they're backed generally by real money and rather than it being some sort of leverage structure. So I think that the banks have generally behaved well, although I think they've behaved well. You know, where we do see some concerns is in markets where yields have come down substantially. So, you know, I think Arif made a good point before in terms of the institutional behavior. You know, what I would say is, you know, institutional behavior in many markets has become very, very polarized. You only have to go to Berlin right now. The pricing on, you know, relatively average buildings in Berlin is extremely strong. On, you know, we're trading something right now, you know, that will trade, you know, at a 3% yield. Banks will finance that at, you know, 60-65%, not recognizing that, you know, in fact they're probably at 100% of a year and a half ago's value. And that's why I think that, you know, the next shock from the banks is in some of these very strong investment markets right now, where interest rates come back up and where some of these yields are unsustainable, and where the banks suddenly realize that their leverage is way higher than they thought.
We've got a couple of questions coming in on Slido. One from Matthew Moody saying, given government's insistence on killing the residential property sector in the UK, I think we're talking about, yet ignoring issues in their backyard, what battle plans are the big boys considering? I think you guys are the said big boys. And kind of any opportunities in the residential sector to look at potential distress? Roger.
Well, maybe I'm a big boy because I'm the fattest in it. I'm not quite sure what you mean by ignoring issues in your backyard. I guess when I think about, if you mean London, which I assume you mean, there certainly is a surfeit of buildings that have been developed for the expat price market. Okay, so, you know, when I run around South Kent, which is where I live, or even south of the river, or, you know, even Grosvenor Square, you look at these properties and you realize that a lot's been, or Earl's Court, things are developed to 1,500 pounds a foot or 2,000 pounds a foot. And whether you were for Brexit or weren't for Brexit, Brexit has stopped London's momentum. And the idea that an expat is going to come to London and buy a place at 15 or 2,000 pounds a foot, in my opinion, is remote. And I think that really what government policy needs to do, to allude to your government policy, is develop a British price point, which to me is 400 to 800 pounds a foot. So it's drastically lower than a lot of the property that's been developed in London. Now, people have talked about, on the panel, the capital structures aren't flawed the way they were in the crisis. So I don't think a lot of these properties have capital structures of, you know, whether it's 100 pounds of loan and the value of the property is 60. So it's not yet a case where we can pile in and buy things. But I think ultimately the clearing price is half of what a lot of the central London residential properties are, and ultimately, in my judgment, the clearing price will have to be a lot lower, and there'll be loss of equity, whether that's owned, the properties are owned by property companies or Chinese individuals or whomever. The problem is, when I speak to these guys today, there's no way they're going to sell. Firstly, they don't believe what I've just said, which is fine, because that's my opinion. But if I'm right, there'll be equity loss, probably not debt loss, and I don't think with the buoyancy in the equity markets today, that's a possibility.
I would say from a policy perspective, one of the government's big failures has been just continuing to push and push and push home ownership as the way of actually solving the housing crisis. And effectively what we've got is, you know, we are a small island, we have constraints on the total amount of land that is there, but then we put far more constraints on by the way that the planning system actually operates. And so actually if you drive into effectively incentivizing people to buy homes and subsidizing them to buy homes, then actually you just make the problem worse in terms of affordability for people. So one of the things that we've been saying for a number of years is that actually built to rent or rental as a tenure and more creative use of local authority sites is something that the government has actually got to do. Now, the slightly encouraging thing is that there do seem to be some signs that they have woken up to this and they are starting to change, but it's a slow process. You know, it seems as though almost every week someone is on the front page of EG announcing that they're going to commit £1 billion into build to rent in the UK. And if you actually look at the amount of capital that has actually been invested, it is a very small fraction of the amount of money that people have talked about wanting to put to work, because the market is not yet at the size that it needs to be. I think it's still going to take another 3 to 5 years to really get to the level of volume where actually it becomes properly institutionalized. But once that happens, and with some proper relaxation of planning in the right parts of the country, then actually we have a chance to do something about it. But it needs much more decisive action from government than we've seen to date.
We've got another couple here. We touched upon the need for Spain to diversify their economy. Isn't the UK too dependent on the financial sector, and Brexit can only exacerbate it further? Cameron. Just that, you know. You've got about 25. You've got about 25 seconds.
My brain was like, Arif. My own opinion of, so I'm going to start with Brexit. I think my own opinion of Brexit is, in the end, we will end up in a muddled version of where we are right now, and that pragmatism will overrule the dogma of any of the sides of the negotiation. So my view is that in the end, we will arrive somewhere with Brexit, which feels a little bit like what has been, probably not as good, but sort of around here. So I don't share the very bearish views or the very optimistic views, frankly, of those that talk about Brexit. The financial services sector, as a participant in it, I think has been a fantastic driver of tax revenue for this country, and I think the government has to be very careful not to scare it away or to regulate it away. If you look at this panel, the nationalities, historic nationalities of the people on the panel, all of whom pay tax here, to realise that it would be a big political mistake to do that. Having said that, I think there is clearly a need, in other parts of the country to improve the infrastructure and to allow, other businesses to develop.
This is, again, an enormous question, probably to conclude. Outside of the core real estate sectors, what are you most concerned by, and where do you see real opportunity? I had down on my piece of paper, what keeps you up at night, as the last sort of question. So what kind of macro geopolitical things are you most worried about, Cyril?
I wouldn't put it as a macro point. I think the biggest challenge for part of our industry is uncertainty and people who just sit on their hands. And uncertainty that comes from Brexit, uncertainty that comes with a possible realignment of values, is 3% the new 5%, is 5% the new 7%, whichever sector, whichever country you want. And while people figure out what the consequences of Brexit may or may not be, while people figure out whether long-term low rates, quantitative easing across all the major economies, actually is reclassifying the core values of underlying assets. A lot of people just wait, and when people wait, that becomes expensive for us. So, rather than a specific macro issue, my concern, we talked about retail. Retail, they've thrown the baby with the bathwater, right? Just people are sitting on their hands because there's very good retail. There's very good secondary and tertiary shopping centers around the UK, which the ref was talking about and owns some of. But while people try to figure out what's good and what's not good, then nothing happens. There's no buyer. A lot of things are happening in the same way in the UK and in other countries. Capital values in Madrid, capital values in Berlin, which Cameron was just referring to. So across the board, that's my single biggest concern.
We've had lots of questions come in on Slido, which is fantastic. Does anybody like to ask a question in the more traditional way? I've got one, I'm not going to last for too much longer, because one that I really wanted to ask, which is, from a kind of technological perspective, are there any advances, or we've touched on retail, but are there any areas of the market that you think distress may come around from as a result of technological change? And, that I've got down here as an example, with AI were to decimate 50% of jobs in the insurance sector, hypothetically, would city offices go into distress, to be simplistic about it? How much are you guys thinking about technological and more fundamental changes as risks? Arif. You haven't had a hard one yet. Come on.
I mean, technology and disrupt. I mean, the fashion now in all these panels across the world in real estate is to talk about disruptive technology, right? And when it comes to our industry, and people say, okay, what's the disruptive technology in our industry? People point to WeWorks and say, you know, these are the new ways that people are going to want to live in an office. Everybody wants to have a beer tap and a basketball hoop, and that's the new kind of office thing.
Are those features of the Orion office? Can you confirm?
Not yet. But we're going to put a climbing wall in there. Those are the new ways that people are saying, okay, the use of space is going to affect things, and therefore what it will do probably is affect the way that we develop our office buildings. And if we were to develop a new office building, we may have to integrate a lot of these things in there. But you're certainly seeing also the relationship between landlord and tenant change. And, you know, you can see some of the public companies creating their own WeWorks. And this ability where people want more flexibility rather than these longer-term lease may affect the way investors look at building these buildings, because if you don't really have a long-term commitment, it's quite hard to get financing, and therefore it's quite equity-intensive. And so the way that tenants will interact with the office space, the kind of flexibility they will want, the type of office they will want, may make some of these secondary office buildings obsolete. And therefore, when you come to buy them, you may have to buy them at a much lower price in order to put a lot more capex or changes into them. And also the lease structures that we may have to put in place may be different. And that, again, has an impact on value. So there's an interesting part of office design, usage, tenant requirements that I think will affect our industry and how we look at it in the future. And the jury is out till now. I mean, does the WeWork model work or not? Some say yes, some say no. So that's one thing that I think technology. The second part is, I think, logistics. You know, a lot of people talk about sheds, and I personally think logistics is changing every day. You know, you can build these mega logistic space, like for Amazon or whatever, that requires no human beings and have all these robots that work. But how do we know whether that will last in the next 5 years or 6 years? And once you've built one of these things, can you sell it or lease it to someone else or not? And again, that has a question mark for investors like us. It's like, do you really want to buy, even if it is a 10-year long lease on a specific Amazon-type shed? Some institutions are buying it because they're saying, you know, long-term income and capacity. So again, we think that logistics will change and will affect the way sheds are used and, again, investments. So you're seeing technology come into different parts of the offer. We talked about the retail, hotels, Airbnb, and, you know, how that works. And that is affecting, again, the hotel industry, the hospitality sector. So, yeah, there's many things to worry about. I think what you need to do is just, you know, be very careful and listen to a lot of what's happening and pick it up as the technology revolution goes on.
Well, that's fascinating stuff. I could cross-examine you guys for twice as long, but you'll be pleased to know that time is out. So if you could just thank the panel in the usual way. Thanks, guys.